Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Today, we have with us Anastasia Slivker. Anastasia is a partner with Norton Rose Fulbright. Anastasia, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Very good to be here.
Awesome. So why don't we start with the firm? What's Norton Rose Fulbright's focus on the early stage ecosystem?
Norton Rose Fulbright, like so many other global law firms, is a full service provider, and it's a full service provider throughout the world. So we have a large presence in both North America, Latin America, Europe, Asia, and Middle East and Africa. Our venture practice expands in throughout those continents. So we work with both companies and investors to help set up and advise on a slew of VC matters, and with a particular practice sitting in both the UK and here in New York, where I'm based out of.
Well, I was about to say we had an opportunity to catch up beforehand. I know you're in the city, one of the largest venture centers in the country. And given the your global presence, why don't we start with just your perspective? I imagine you see all manner of different transactions type, price equity rounds, notes, debt facilities, acquisitions. What's your perspective, as you look across the landscape today? We know that there's a whole host of macro factors playing out, higher interest rates, now tariffs.
Yes.
For our audience, this is being recorded in late May 2025. Just as a starting point, where do you see things given your vantage point?
Christian, that's an excellent question, because if you ask me on any one week, that vantage point continues to change as the microeconomic environment it seems to impact our, it's going to be tomorrow and we'll have some clarity, and that gets pushed out and pushed out and pushed out. But I would say that, let me maybe separate and divide out these two. There are two ways to think about this question. And the first is, what are we seeing more in the market in what I'm going to call in the venture capital to growth equity stage? And then really talk a little bit about how we're seeing that play out today in the deals that we're seeing and what that means, again, as you correctly pointed out, end of May 2025. So with respect to the first question, one of the challenges of having these conversations is we sometimes use different words to mean different things. Sure. So maybe it's worth stopping here and pausing to say that, as a venture capital and growth equity, private equity lawyer, I look at the spectrum of the evolution of a company. What I mean by that is from its birth to its exit, whether that's through M&A or through a public offering, I work with companies at their full life cycle of that arc. And I work with investors that invest in different parts of those life cycles, and they all specialize in slightly different types of investment vehicles in which they are best suited in. And so when I think about what we're seeing in this space, I'm going to, for a minute, move aside the pure venture capital. The pure venture capital play continues to be really, really active, at least in our firm. It continues to be active in a number of industries. And so we see it in digital infrastructure. We see it in financial services. We see it in insurance. We see it in a number of industries that where it continues to make economic sense to do those deals, right? Coming to that second point. On where I spend so much of my time, kind of threading the needle to make things work is in a space that I call growth equity. I call it that. You may have a very different definition of that. Our listeners may have a third and their neighbor might have a fourth, right? I think it means something different for all of us. So, and that's the place where we're seeing both challenges and movement. So there's the struggle of trying to figure out how to put it together, and also seeing that not as many deals as we would think. Many deals get started, not as many of them get to close. And so, and that's one of the things that maybe is so interesting in this space is, unlike in the pure venture capital place, it's essentially, you know, once you're out there raising cash, the terms are relatively clearly set. We're doing sort of using a set of forms that everybody's very comfortable with. In this particular space, there is a lot of variation on the theme. So it's a much more pick your own adventure kind of experience.
Okay. And so what do you attribute to being, or reasons for not seeing deals make their way to the finish line?
So, and it's a great question. There's really three different reasons. And if I can preview them, one is, what I would say, unmatched expectations. So the parties coming in and they're thinking they're talking about the same thing, but they have slightly different expectations, but they'd really like to work together, but they never really have a clear discussion throughout the negotiation process about what those expectations are. So it's a much more kind of soft reason why sometimes these deals don't get to the finish line. The second reason is macroeconomic. So I've, you know, been working on a deal where, you know, certain rumblings in Congress caused our investor to say, maybe we'll wait to do this particular transaction. And then the third is there may be genuine meeting of the minds on expectations. There may be even modeling built in for some of the risk that we're seeing in macroeconomic reasons. But when it comes to the details of how exactly you're going to run this transaction, the actual mechanics, because they're sort of post, they're not quite VC. They're a little bit further along, I guess, again, in that VC space, I mean, in the growth equity space. It's the tough conversations happen a little bit late. And those tough conversations are about exit and they're about control. And they're not often about valuation. Those conversations get solved really quickly and folks think, oh, we're done. We've got ourselves a deal. Aha. But then there are these really hairy details on how the economics stay the economics. And they're not an afterthought. They're very much part of the core of the transaction.
And so what's an example, if it's not valuation related? Would it be like holdback, other exit terms that the founders have to agree to?
Yeah, I mean, I think exit is really a really big pain point. And so, you know, I often talk to both the investors and when we represent the targets on the company side, and I really urge parties to think about hey, this is a relationship that you're getting into that is actually more often than not intended to be marriage. You never really stay married. You're going to separate at some point. And so you need to have a very clear conversation of how and when that happens and under what terms. So because the likelihood that you are going to exit together through an IPO, for example, is actually not how the mechanics of the deal are set up. I mean, think of just your very basic pref deal, which is the world that I live in, you know, pref equity. That's 90% of what I do. And pref equity can be very equity-like and it can be very debt-like. You'll hear me, Christian, say, and most of my clients and have heard me say, it's an accordion. And like an accordion, it could be both equity-like and debt-like, but you can play it in all sorts of ways. As the movement comes in and out and the sound comes out, you're also playing the keys. And so there's these multiple movements that are impacting the sound that comes out. And that's why, to me, this balancing act of equity versus debt versus how that preferred is going to, you know, how, what the convertible mechanics are, what the call options are, the redemption rights, mandatory, non-mandatory, all those seem like frustrating lawyer details. I hate to say it, they're not. They're the core economics.
So it's interesting. So I heard you loud and clear. Three issues at play. It's easy to hone in on the macroeconomic because that's a variable that we can look at rates, we can look at tariffs, we can look at the administration and decisions that are getting made. But is that really at the heart of what's driving the other two criteria of not getting parties to see eye to eye, or is there something else fundamentally different than a year or two or ago?
So let me take with the first one, because the first one is what I'm going to call the it's not quantitative, it's qualitative. It's hard to describe this in rigid financial terms. It's humans interacting as humans, right? It's the do I get the warm and fuzzies feelings? And that's a really hard conversation, I think, to breach, because it is about working dynamics. It's about how the teams see each other, if they share a common vision, if they share a common philosophy of how they work. But I think it's also to some extent focused on how the growth of the company is going to be executed. Who is going to be running? How will they be running this? And this is the part about the expectation setting exercise that I think is so important to have really at the onset, right? And I think, a lot of folks, as I mentioned to you, I come from the VC growth equity to private equity arc, right? With call it the public markets exit is sort of one of the other exit strategies. But because I have this kind of deep appreciation for an exit that is kind of in the private equity world, I can tell you that it's really important to think about that as the buyer, right? As the ultimate acquirer in the space. And so I am hesitant to sort of say that there isn't a necessarily one single exit strategy for anyone and any one investor. And again, this ties back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier. The exit strategy and the do we think about this the same way? Is this going to be a private equity buyer? Are we going to go public? How is this going to look like? This is all part of the expectation setting exercise. So the macroeconomics on this don't, you can theoretically say that they are impacted, but that's not what's really at play. That's sort of separate and aside.
It's interesting. It sounds like you're having to act like mediator as well, and that the parties would be well served to kind of like figure this out before they get to the negotiating table to write up the deal.
And I think, Christian, that's exactly right. That's the reason why in the private equity world, you see folks, going out to dinners and spending time in factories. I think there's this, get to know each other, quick date. We're about to sort of get hitched. And I think that you see that in a place where, again, this is sort of a caveat that we're talking often about minority positions, but we shouldn't dismiss these being not just minority positions, right? There could be majority ownership. It's just that the investors relinquishing control because that's not their business. They want the existing folks to continue to run that. And so there is, in that sense, almost a private equity-like interaction, but the model isn't that because, and again, the investor may be more akin to a venture capital investor, maybe has been in the VC space, maybe it's a family office, right? Who has done things a certain way, but would like to get into, for example, energy and renewables, battery storage, data centers, any one of the new kind of topics that are, or newer topics that are drawing a lot of growth equity and investment, capital investment.
I've got a bunch more questions, but before we do, I think it would be valuable if we take a step back and you can share with us your career progression and how you ended up advising your clients on these transactions.
Well, this is no career path is ever linear, and certainly mine has not been. Although I think it probably was a more focused and less accidental than some, in the sense that I became an M&A lawyer very much by choice. I thought I was going to be an antitrust lawyer, and then realized that actually I wanted to really do the whole transaction, not just the piece of it. And candidly, that I wasn't made to be a litigator. I was meant to be a negotiator. I'm I like to get to yes, and so that's a very comfortable place to be when I'm helping to put together the transaction, get the deal to work, find creative solutions, think about strategies, work with bankers, investment, finance folks, and really sort of act as the consigliere and the, like you said, the sort of the peacemaker. And when I was thinking about where that personality fits best, for me, it actually wasn't in M&A. I think that there's a potential, perhaps a reputation for corporate M&A lawyers to be very bullish and aggressive. And I find it to be a place actually where collaboration really gets the best results. And so I take that philosophy and apply it in sort of the everyday how I look and structure transactions and trying to make sure that everybody wins. I think transactions where everybody wins are those that get across the finish line and are successful after the fact. And so M&A was an easy kind of place to find myself as a budding lawyer. And then I looked around and thought, you know, I'd really love to have an industry expertise. And that industry expertise for me was very easy to identify, and it was in energy and renewables and infrastructure. And so, yeah, I had and the transition was a little bit challenging because I was just an M&A lawyer that was buying and selling what I call widgets at that point. And it's a little bit challenging to break into a space when you're already, you know, have been a lawyer for a couple of years and then want to, in essence, pivot, but also stay committed to the experience that you already have. For me, that meant that I went back and did a program at NYU. I did that with the help of NYSERDA, which is a fantastic organization that helped to finance my education so that I could build more energy efficient deals in New York State. So many thanks to NYSERDA and NYU for supporting me in my transition from just being your widgets M&A lawyer to one that has this really fascinating focus in renewables. And one that has, as those projects have started to change, I've also expanded my the work that I do into digital infrastructure, and that's led to to expand from energy to infrastructure to digital infrastructure to technology, and sort of now there's a much larger footprint. But increasingly, Christian, it's so fascinating to see how much each of those are intertwined. This is, once in a while I'll do an insurance deal, of course, that happens. But, you know, this industry is really, really interrelated.
So it's interesting. So fast forward, you're back at the firm. You made a comment earlier that put a smile on my face, and that was that you're continuing to see a lot of deal flow, which is great. With our firm, we're industry agnostic, so we work across the spectrum of industries. And, you know, like you, I continue to see a whole host of activity taking place, which is obviously really encouraging. But, you know, I'm curious, when you talk to the other partners at the firm, I mean, is it ubiquitous, or is it because, you know, you have this track record of being focused in energy infrastructure that it just happens to be the right place at the right time, and hallelujah, you know, there's a lot of deal activity taking place.
You know, Christian, and this is, this may be, you're sending me an easy pitch here. You know, we at NRF have been very busy, in part because the industries in which we are very active in, which we are in fact industry agnostic, but the places where we have a really strong footprint continue to be very busy. And, you know, we have been very lucky to have a very, very experienced regulatory team in the different subject matter in the various industries. And because change means, you know, a lot of regulatory advice, we're still seeing a lot of deal flow because we're able to structure around some of that risk. Now, they're not all risk and not all macroeconomic risk can be structured around. And we are certainly seeing that. I can tell you that today I was having a conversation with one of our clients that's looking to sell a portfolio of assets. And, you know, he voiced to me concern about, you know, whether or not they're getting the best deal possible because they're getting some of the risk priced in, even though their asset is, you know, more likely than not going to be outside of some of the recent changes and will be grandfathered in. But even that is being priced in. So there's a frustration that, you know, the valuation isn't where it should be based on that. But overall, I think that we've been very blessed to see still a lot of deals come through. I think, like I said before, Christian, there are, in my world, the challenges, and I think that this is outside of the macroeconomic aspects of this, they're just a little bit more challenging to get over the finish line because they're so bespoke.
Yeah, I know. I believe it. You know, and I, you know, I, obviously difficult to do on this podcast, but you know, one of the reoccurring things that we know that came out of the beginning of the pandemic is just higher valuations that have since compressed. You know, and so you can absolutely see how that contributes to mismatched expectations because you're anchored to just this bigger number. And if you're a buyer, you're sensitive to, you know, what you're getting for your money. You know, the thing, so I think about that just in terms of exits, you know, a lot of conversation taking place around the glut of IPOs. And so you see, you know, you're starting to see emergence of secondaries. Would love your perspective.
So look, I'm a recovering de-SPAC lawyer. And so I make that joke. But in all seriousness, I think that, you know, the reason I say this is there was a time when M&A lawyers were really, really busy doing a lot of de-SPAC deals. Yep. And I certainly was a part of that team and worked and spent some time at a law firm that is one of the founding law firms for this type of work. And so was sort of had my some really great training wheels in terms of volume and deal structures, et cetera, and continued to take that with me to Norton Rose Fulbright, where we've closed a handful of de-SPAC deals really even as late as earlier in this year. So, which takes me to sort of maybe an unexpected turn. I'm seeing de-SPACs pick up. We're seeing that come back into the fold in a very different way, right? Everyone's very sober minded about it. You know, it's not a tulip frenzy anymore. And so the musical chairs have sort of all, you know, the game has been played, and now we're all just trying to figure out how to structure these deals. And a lot of it has to do with how the pipe is raised. And so there are certain ways in which that as a strategy is going to work for a handful of companies, depending on what their profile are. And so a couple of factors that impact that. It is, you know, whether they're, you know, pre-revenue, whether there is what their existing equity stack looks like, what their shareholder base looks like, and candidly, what kind of pipe they're able to raise. Because the general premise that there's going to be, you know, that there's going to be full redemptions, I think remains true. That the expectation is that there is close to or nearly full redemptions at the time of the closing of the de-SPAC. So the pipe becomes the real tool for raising capital. But we're also seeing, and you know, I'm want to give a plug out to my colleague, Kevin Friedman, who's done some really great thought leadership on other types of private placements and other tools that are sort of not the full Monty IPO, right? What I would call anything sub that, because I think to do, you know, having the IPO as the gold standard is certainly true for a number of companies. It doesn't always make sense. And I think we're looking at markets that have, you know, with players that look like, you know, I think there were high expectations that maybe haven't done quite as well as the market had initially suggested before their IPO in the last, you know, 12 months. And I think that some of these other strategies are starting to look a little bit more appealing.
Out of curiosity, do you have an opinion of what you attribute the lack of performance post-IPO to?
Oh man, I'm not stepping on those rusty nails. No, look, I think it's a number of factors, right? I think it's in each case you can almost pinpoint it, you know, in retrospect, 2020. Oh, maybe it's probably it's some of this, it may be a little bit of that. But and I don't think it's ever any one thing. But you know, I think that the what I'm going to call the traditional IPO is an excellent tool, and there are certainly I think lots of companies that would be well placed to use that as a strategy. There are also lots of really great companies that can be very successful and use other similar tools that are not necessarily the, you know, the kind of standard IPO.
Interesting. So, and the founders I've spoken with before have taken their companies public. There's been a theme that they, and albeit they've predominantly been men, there's been a theme that they imagined it was what it would be like to give birth. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, because I've not taken a company public yet. But can you comment on just like the process? I mean, obviously we know it's involved, tremendous amount of just scrutiny on making shares available to the public. But what insights could you give to the founders who are listening to this, who are contemplating, working with a firm like yours, who may be thinking, you know what, I actually want to go this route.
Look, I think that there are, again, depending on, right, you have to right size fit the solution, right? First, there's a process of, well, why are you have, what is the purpose of this IPO? It is to do what, right? If it's sort of a trophy, it's a slightly different conversation than, hey, we want to raise this amount of cash. We need this for, you know, we want to do this type of work when we come out of it. We need this much for M&A out of this, you know. And so again, and I sort of want to emphasize that the reason for the exit, this as an exit strategy, we have to match the problem with the solution, so to speak, right? So first I would say is really the team, you know, presumably is doing some soul searching for why they'd like to be public. Being public is a it's a tremendous amount of work. It's expensive, right? You're having to do filings. You have to do, there's all sorts of paperwork, administrative processes that are involved. And so it's got to be worth it. And it's got to be worth it because you're spending, you know, anywhere from a couple $100,000 a year for your small cap company to millions of dollars a year just doing security compliance. And it's got to make economic sense. So the first part is, you know, I would say, hey, what's the reason why, what is this intended to do? How do you intend to raise capital? And look, most of the time the answer is yes, it still makes sense, right? But at least that should be the first step in the thought process, the analysis is, hey, what is this going to look like? And what's the ambition? I think that in terms of, you know, what we tend to think about by the time we are sort of engaged by our clients as they're going through the IPO process is, you know, hey, we'd like to have an IPO. Can you help us put together our you know, proxy statement and whatever it may be that we're, you know, we're going to file the S-4 proxy statement. And so, you know, what I would say in that regard is that is part of the that is very much the principal task. But there's also a lot that goes on through that process that we're here to guide you on, right? And candidly, we're here to guide you just because we've done it many times. And because I think, again, Christian, you may have heard me that I'm much more of a, I take a much more collaborative approach, and so do my colleagues, in the sense that we don't want you to cliff right after your IPO, right? We want to set you up with the right team to make sure that you've got your HR issues. You know, there's a process for that, right? That your, you know, equity plan works and that it's the right size and you've thought about how and when you're going to grant it and what the next, you know, 3, 4, 5 years are going to look like on your business strategy. And does that match your equity plan, right? And how that's going to work. Very often, you know, kind of thought I see folks thinking about this in the 12th hour as they're trying to finalize and finish the IPO, whereas really that's a conversation that we need to start relatively early on. Executive compensation, all of those things, the operational aspect of being a publicly traded company, these processes, you want to set them up early and you want to think about the logistics. You know, I think that wars are not won by with having the right strategy. It's won with the right logistics.
You know, I as I'm listening, you can't help but tease out a reoccurring theme that there's as the your business grows, you just have to appreciate so does the scope and scale, and by consequence, planning that needs to take place in order to be successful. And so, let me ask, you know, I've picked up a something I like to use and share with the team. You know, the 7 P's: proper prior planning prevents piss poor performance. And you know,
here,
so
here.
And that, you know, it served me really well in my career. And so one of the ways I like to think about it is something Wayne Gretzky said a long time ago. It's like, you know, you go where the puck is going to be, not where it is. So just this idea of, hey, let me just think ahead and, you know, to the best of my ability, answer the question, what's my vision and what steps do I need to take in order to get there? So if there's any advice that you would give to a founder who maybe they just closed an A, B, you know, they see they've got this great trajectory. What steps can they take now in anticipation of the future?
I can't help but smile and say, you know, call Christian and his team because no, but you know, I do think it's I think that's really the truth is there's a So one of the challenges, you asked a question earlier, so let me make sure that I answer fully that question. One of the biggest challenges in the process of going through an IPO, or candidly, any sort of exit, whatever the alternative may look like, is it's a massive distraction from the core business, right? You're now in the business of doing that business, right? And you're not doing this business. And I do my very best, and me and my team do my very best to take as much of that load on ourselves, but there's no there's no substitute for you who is the, you know, deeply embedded and know your business. And so the more that you can think about, well, what do I want that strategy to look like? Who do I want to partner with? When do I want to exit? You know, what is, and you know, I say this to founders, especially groups of founders, where it's 2-3 founders, is what is your relationship? What is the dynamic? What happens if one of you decides that they want to change, you know, their lifestyle? And these conversations, you know, it's good to have them honestly and candidly early. And then I think, you know, in to your 7 P's, it's the organization to give you the flexibility to make the decision you want in the future so that you have everything in the place where it needs to be. So it's not a scramble, so that you continue to run your business. And so being organized, being having the right amount of processes in place without sort of overspending, I think that's the other challenge, is it's always easy to throw money at things, but does that make sense? Is the balancing act. But organization, communication, candor with other senior executives, and I think I sometimes tell my clients that, you know, as we're structuring something, is to, you know, hey, take the evening, do some soul searching, right? Is this what you want? Does this make sense? Is, you know, is are you going to come out of this and feel like, hey, I really got the right deal. This makes sense for me and my, you know, stakeholders and my shareholders and all the folks that sort of depend on me? Because typically by the time you're talking to me, you've got folks that really depend on you.
Yeah. You know, as I listen to you, I think to myself, you know, human capital is extremely valuable. Making sure you have, you know, a dependable, competent C-suite, I imagine, becomes crucial. And because it's, you know, the same as just financing round. I mean, it's almost a full-time job, even if it's a seed or an A. Anastasia, ton of great insights. Thank you. Before we wrap up, one of my go-to questions I love to ask. If you had an opportunity to go back, have a conversation with your younger self, what would you share? Boy.
Go to business school. you know, I really love the type of law that I practice because I help to build companies, and I think that I value continued learning. And so my old self, I would have said, hey, given the opportunity to drop in and listen in to, you know, take a finance class at, you know, while in law school, or just learn more of the world around you while it's available to you. Spend more time learning when there's more time for it. That's what I would tell my old self.
I love it. Great, great, great advice. Before we wrap up, more recent question that I've been asking our guests is, if you had anyone in your network that you think would be great to have on the podcast to share their perspective? Who comes to mind?
Yeah, absolutely. I can tell you right now off the bat, I have a my colleague who's just very squarely focused on venture capital, and he advises a number of financial institutions who are making strategic investments into targets at the venture capital stage. And we work together as a team. We are very much kind of part of the continuum of often overlapping. I think it would be interesting to you've now heard my perspective in my kind of more growth equity leaning space for you to hear his perspective, especially one from a person who represents so many really incredible investors.
Oh, what's his name?
My colleague Ryan Wagner. Hi,
Oh,
Ryan.
there you go, Ryan. All right. Well, Ryan, it sounds like you're going to get a call from us. So stay tuned. Anastasia, if there are any members of our audience who like to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
Please find me. I'm if not the only, I'm one of two Anastasias in North America at Norton Rose Fulbright. Google Norton Rose Fulbright, drop in my name, and you should see a very, very outdated picture. That gal is actually me. So please find me. You've got my contact information there. I look forward to hearing from you. Please let me know your insights, thoughts, where you agree and disagree. Particularly if you disagree, please let me know. I'm so curious to brainstorm with any of you.
Fantastic. Well, Anastasia, I really appreciate your time. Thank you for making yourself available. And, also to your credit, being challenged on your perspective, though I thought it was really valuable to hear. Again, Anastasia, for the benefit of our audience, Anastasia Slivker, partner at Norton Rose Fulbright. And again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder, CEO of Finstrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Take care.
Thank you.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. If you'd like to know more, go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is at finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.